When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
First, it was Sweden, voting in the right-wing Sweden Democrats as the largest party in the winning bloc. That was last week. Now it's Italy, choosing Giorgia Meloni's Brothers of Italy party over all of the others so that she will now become Italian Prime Minister. So, is this fascism? Is it a far-right wave? Is it a national populist insurgency against distant technocrat overlords? Or is it more likely to be more of the same? One analyst who makes a special study of right-wing populism is Ralf Schoelhammer. He joins us from Vienna, where he is an economics and political science lecturer at Webster University. Hi, Ralf.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's very great to be on with you today.
So, first of all, let's start with Italy. I want to do a bit of a tour of Europe with you, if that's okay. But starting with the most recent news, the newspapers here in England are covering this as if essentially fascism has returned to Europe. Is that true?
No. And it's I'm very glad you mentioned English newspapers. It's the same in German-speaking newspapers and Austrian newspapers. Where I find myself, I think the commentariat in the United States is very similar. Sometimes one gets the impression that every major media outlet has a pre-prepared article, and every time a slightly right-of-center party wins, they just take the same article and, you know, fill in party name here. So it's Sweden Democrats, or it is the Brothers of Italy, or it's the Freedom Party, or it's Fidesz, but the articles are pretty much always the same. I think this is particularly interesting in the case of Giorgia Meloni in Italy, because if we look at her, and she also has written a very interesting biography, and there were some interesting articles about her that actually went a little bit into depth and talked to her personally. So they weren't just talking about her, they were actually talking with her. And what one finds out, she's much more like a classic conservative than anything that we would put into the realm of fascism. And in many areas, she just says things that should be very familiar, interestingly enough, to be those on the political left, right? She's kind of, you know, against the kind of global financial exploitation. She's critical of globalization generally. So all things that Bernie Sanders, for example, of all people, would probably also sign off to. So it's a very problematic issue only because she comes at it from a nationalist perspective. Now, is she a nationalist? Most definitely. Like the whole slogan of her is God, country, family. And this is resonating with people. It's resonating in Italy, but I think it's resonating beyond the borders of Italy, especially in times of economic hardship. Because what's the one thing people tend to rely on in hard times? It's the family. So I think these things become much more important than they have been in the past.
So is it true that God, country, family was a fascist slogan popular during the time of Mussolini? And if so, is it fair to say that she is kind of signaling, you know, a deliberate echo there?
Yeah, I mean, that argument can be made, but I think that's a very tricky thing because it's like saying that every socialist party is somehow Marxist or communist. Of course, there are certain parallels, right? A national conservative party, that there are some areas of overlap with, if you want to call it fascist ideology, that's hard to avoid. I think this is neither an indictment nor an excuse. It is and particularly Italian fascism was always different from German fascism, without going too much into a historical debate. So even within Italy itself, I think these things tend to be seen differently. But the idea, I think that's the important thing, the idea that the Brothers of Italy have a plan now to, you know, abolish democracy, as some people warn, and that this is going to be the end of free and fair elections in Italy, all of that is not true. I mean, the hallmark of fascism in the end is it's totalitarian, it's a one-party state, It's full control of all levels of government by one party. It's nationalization, either of the industries or the form of corporatism, where the government simply tells companies what they have to do. So in all these elements, I don't see. So we can throw out the term fascism and say, ooh, Meloni likes or loves Italy. The fascists loved Italy or proclaimed to do so. Therefore, she's a fascist. I think this is such a simple way of looking at the complexity of ideologies, that we as commentators and journalists, we really shouldn't do this. I think it's irresponsible, misleading, and plainly wrong.
Not a fascist, but you say a true conservative. She clearly talks a lot. You said God, family, nation. I mean, she talks a lot about Catholic ideas, about she's unashamedly religious person. Where she is, I suspect, most kind of striking and frightening to ears of voters in places like the UK is when she talks about things like gender. She's unabashedly pro a heterosexual family. She wants to ban adoption by gay couples. She's not going to be marching in a gay pride march anytime soon, waving a banner, that's for sure. What's your sense of that? Like, how extreme is she on those kind of social issues?
One thing that distinguishes particular Meloni from other politicians, let's take, for example, Berlusconi, right? Silvio Berlusconi is also a right-wing politician in more or less. But Berlusconi always had, not without reason, an almost artificial taste to him, right? There's a flamboyant a TV producer who obviously is not disinclined to use Botox on a regular basis, and the whole, you know, call girl affairs and all these kind of things. So
he's definitely right-winger. Looking good for an 80-plus-year-old.
I could not agree more. But Meloni has something, and as many people make this comparison, I allow myself to make this comparison as well. She has something that Trump had as well. She's authentic. Like, she is not. This is not a politician that is focus grouped. She's from Rome. She speaks with a Roman Italian accent. I guess in Great Britain, correct me if I'm using the wrong term, it's like what I guess a Cockney slang or like language-wise would be. So she can relate to the working class because she speaks like them. She was not marinated in universities for a long time of her career. So she comes from a more of a working class background than others. And this is resonating with people. And you pointed out to another important element. She claims in a recent speech, which I have to admit, I find somewhat persuasive. She says that family is something real, that gender is something real, that women are something real. These things exist. They're not just something you can ascribe or decide to have. These are things that actually exist. As she says, I'm a woman, I'm a mother, I'm an Italian. I'm not just, you know, person one, person two, or progenitor A or progenitor B. And she claims that, as we sometimes call the elites, want to take that away. And I think that message does resonate.
We've got the clip of, I think, the speech you're referring to. So let's play that and have a look at it.
Potrei farne tante altre di queste domande. A monte c'è quella che ci facciamo oggi. Perché la famiglia è un nemico? Perché la famiglia fa così paura? C'è una risposta unica per tutte queste domande. Perché ci definisce, perché è la nostra identità. Perché tutto quello che ci definisce in questo tempo è un nemico. Per chi vorrebbe che non avessimo più un'identità e che fossimo solamente schiavi, consumatori perfetti. E allora è sotto attacco l'identità nazionale, è sotto attacco l'identità religiosa, è sotto attacco l'identità di genere, è sotto attacco l'identità familiare. Non devo potermi definire italiana, cristiana, donna, madre, no. Io devo essere cittadino X, genere X, genitore 1, genitore 2, devo essere un numero. Perché quando sarò solamente un numero, quando non avrò più un'identità, quando non avrò più radici, beh, allora sarò lo schiavo perfetto in balia della grande speculazione finanziaria, il consumatore perfetto. E questa è la ragione per la quale... Questa è la ragione per la quale oggi noi facciamo tanta paura. Questa è la ragione per la quale oggi questo appuntamento fa tanta paura. Perché noi non vogliamo essere dei numeri, noi siamo qui per dire che noi non siamo dei numeri, noi difenderemo il valore della persona umana, di ogni singola persona umana, perché ognuno di noi ha un codice genetico unico e irripetibile. E questo, piaccia o no, ha del sacro. Lo difenderemo, difenderemo Dio, la patria e la famiglia, che fanno tanto schifo a qualcuno. Lo faremo per difendere la nostra libertà, perché noi non saremo mai schiavi e semplici consumatori in balia della speculazione finanziaria. Ecco la nostra missione, ecco perché oggi sono venuta qui. Scriveva Chesterton ormai più di un secolo fa, vediamo se ve lo trovo, fuochi verranno attizzati per dimostrare che 2 più 2 fa 4, spade verranno sguainate per dimostrare che le foglie sono verdi in estate. Quel tempo è arrivato, signori, siamo pronti, grazie.
So what she's doing there is this quite interesting move, which is she's talking about identity issues, gender, religion, and so on, and she's making it into a kind of an almost an anti-capitalist sounding movement, where it's the kind of international finance wants to reduce people to just consumers or cells in a spreadsheet, and she feels like her humanity and that collection of identities is more important than that. So if it's conservative, it's a quite strange kind of conservatism, at least in that statement, because she doesn't talk like she's on the side of big business, of financial markets. Do you think she's actually going to act like that, or do you think she will be more conventionally conservative in office?
That's going to be the interesting question. I mean, one thing that she speaks to in this particular clip that I find particularly convincing is there is a trend in Europe and the United States, generally in the West, that on the matter of identity, we grant identity to specific groups, the ones that she mentions, right? Whether it's in the LGBTQ community or in migrant background, all these kind of things. We are very strong, which is fine, in recognizing the identity of those people. But at the same time, we do deny traditional identities, right? Being a Christian, being a nationalist, being a patriot, being an Italian. I think she speaks to this very well. There is a mistake, and she's not the only one that makes that mistake, that this is driven by big business, that this is driven by companies. I don't think that's the case. I think that companies latch onto it, right? If all the cultural institutions, the media institutions, the celebrity class, right, if they all promote a certain worldview, it's absolutely natural that companies then latch onto it in the hope of making more business. So this is why I think that on the long run, there is not much that she can or will do about it. I mean, what's the idea? The Italians still will want to consume. So she's not going to close down companies. She's not going to close down factories. But what I do think is going to happen, and this will be interesting to observe in Europe, I think that gradually companies will shift. I think there will be a realization, some of them faster, others slower, to say, wait a moment, our consumers are changing, that patriotism is en vogue again. Right? The traditional identities seem to be more popular than we thought they would be. And you will see companies use that as well. All of a sudden, you will have companies that used a year ago the rainbow flag will now, a year from now, come up with the Italian flag. So companies adapt to whatever they think is the most popular thing. The idea that they are the driving force behind it, I always found this a little bit of an exaggeration. Give or take, I mean, there are some they are. We talked about this, and Anhurt has written about this extensively, like BlackRock and ESG. So there are some that are really pushing it. But I think that is going to be, the pendulum will swing in another direction fairly soon.
So what's interesting there is also to watch what happens in the coming months with Meloni, because already some of the people who supported her originally are feeling like she might be becoming a bit of a sellout, you know, just as the kind of centre-left commentariat are outraged and up in arms about how right-wing she seems, her kind of populist voters maybe are already getting disappointed or maybe about to get disappointed, because on some big things, you know, she was talking about being a Eurosceptic earlier in her career, and she seems to have ditched that. On the Ukraine issue, she's absolutely fully signed up Atlanticist, which again doesn't necessarily chime with some of her more populist voters. So what's your assessment of that? Is she about to disappoint part of her electorate?
So it was this conservative patriotism that swept her into office. But that is not enough, right? It's a which I personally also find important, but it's a sentiment, it's a feeling. She expresses the matters that are really important, and I think they are. But now, as you just hit the nail on the head, now it's about to govern. So how can you translate that, let's say, ideological, emotional vision in actual politics? And Italy has massive structural problems. Italy is a historically difficult country to govern. So this is not going to be easy for her. So she might not be a sellout, but there are many structural obstacles that she has to overcome. The Italian bureaucracy, the Italian party states, the differences between Northern Italy and Southern Italy. So this, in a sense, if I would be facetious, I would say, I'm being cynical here, please don't misunderstand me, but you probably need to be almost a quote-unquote Mussolini-like character, if you will, to really take on the many structural problems that Italy has. And what I mean by this is you need to be somebody who is not afraid potentially to lose the next elections. You need to be somebody who says, I was elected, I thank you for that, but what we have to do now will come at great pain for some, right? The Italian state, Italian bureaucracy, Italian civil service, it's inflexible, it's ineffective. So many of those who she needs to rule are also those whom she needs to reform. And that's a problem in every government, and independently if it's a left-wing or right-wing thing. So this is going to be very, very, very hard for her. She can only hope, and that's what I hope that she's going to do, that she says, if she really has a strong popular base, that she governs via the popular base, that she really uses the popularity she has within the Italian population to reform the Italian state. If she does not do that, she's just going to end like Berlusconi or Draghi before her. So the election victory is one thing. The contemporary popularity is one thing. You know, let her enjoy the current moment. But this is going to be very, very difficult in the years and months to come.
And also, she only got 21. We don't know the final results yet. 20-something percent of the vote. So it's not like she has a majority among the population. About 1 in 5 people, it appeared, voted for her. So
precisely.
We mentioned there some of the internal obstacles she's going to face in sort of institutions and bureaucracy. The other one, which we haven't talked about yet, is the European Union. There was a clip that was circulating on social media of Ursula von der Leyen saying pretty straightforwardly that if the new Italian government steps out of line, there'll be a price to pay. Let's have a watch of that.
We'll see if things go in a difficult direction. I've spoken about Hungary and Poland. We have tools. If things go in the right direction, and people as a body that is always, where always governments have to be accountable to, play an important role.
Okay, so she says, if things go in a difficult direction, which looks like they now have, we have tools. That people were getting quite excited about. It sounded quite sinister, a kind of threat. What are those tools?
No, this is a threat. And there are, of course, certain tools, whether it's financing within the European Union, then, of course, even the European Central Bank is not as much an independent institution as we tend to believe. So if European institutions, whether officially and publicly or you know, in a more hidden way, try to sabotage this Italian government, they could. And this is particularly true, maybe of interest to the listeners as well. This is particularly true for Italy because, to a very large extent, the Italian economy over the last years was kept afloat by the European Central Bank. So Italy, despite being a G7 nation and despite still having a very impressive export industry, Italy depends heavily on its European partners for its financing. So that could be a problem. The question is, of course, on the long run, as von der Leyen also said in this speech, is can the European Union really expect to move on kind of cohesively if this is the new approach? So every time a country votes in a government that Ms. von der Leyen doesn't like, you literally threaten them with not sanctions, but as she calls it, tools. So this is going to become at some point an existential threat, I believe, for the European Union. Particularly, one last sentence on this, particularly because German leadership especially is no longer very popular within the European Union. It would be different if over the last 2 years everybody would agree that German leadership has been, you know, exemplary and they lead the way and everybody wants to follow. That's no longer the case. So her then using such a threatening tone, that can, on the long run or medium run, really be kind of a problem.
So essentially, we end up with a very particular kind of populism here. It's a populism that's shaped into the hole which it's allowed to occupy, almost. I mean, we had examples in recent years of different types of populism which actually had more ambitious goals. For example, Greece, when they, you know, the famous no vote, when they actually tried to throw off the diktats of the European Union, that failed. And so what we're seeing in their neighbour Italy now is almost like populism in those areas which she's allowed to have some control over. So we might see quite a conventional attitude to the European Union, to big international foreign policy issues like Ukraine, maybe to international finance. But on things where she's allowed to make noise, which is talking about identity, gender, rules about, you know, things like gay adoption, she can do something, and probably also immigration. Is that right? I mean, we haven't spoken about that, but what should we now expect? In her stump speeches, she was talking about bringing the Navy in to put an end to sea crossings. I mean, do you think things like that will happen in reality?
It's going to be interesting. It's very similar to the situation we had in 2016 in the United States. If you remember, Donald Trump's slogan was "Build the Wall." It's very similar. The Italians can't build a wall, but they could hypothetically use the Navy. Is she going through with it? I mean, it's absolutely clear. If she does do it, the media backlash within Europe will be severe. So does she have the stamina and the guts to stand by what she has announced in light of these headwinds that she's going to encounter? Within the Italian population, I think that would only increase her popularity, because migration, especially as it happens from Northern Africa, is not popular in Italy. The Italians are very aware, as are the Swedes. Once we switch and talk about a little bit about the Sweden Democrats, there is a severe and significant unhappiness with the migration politics of the last 20 years. But there will have to be more. So migration alone is not going to cut it. Italians are just as most other Europeans worried about cost of living. So she will have to talk about that as well and do something about that as well. So there are many areas that are, it could not be a more difficult political, economic and social environment in which she came to power. And that's a little bit the paradox that you also mentioned. The very conditions that brought her into power will also be the very conditions that are so difficult to deal with. And it's simply at this point too soon to say what's going to happen. I mean, the one thing that we can say with almost 100% certainty is Italy is not going to turn into a fascist state. I mean, of all the problems with Italy, I would even say that's the smallest issue there is. But can Italy make the necessary steps to recover? And that's not the last point on this. That's not just important for Italy itself. Italy is large enough in the worst case to drag down the entirety of the European Union, economically at least. So if she can push the necessary reforms to make Italy strong again, that would be to the benefit of the entirety of Europe.
Let's move to Sweden. You mentioned it there. Clearly, this happened a week before, and in a lot of people's minds, this is proof of a trend. It means that there's some kind of populist wave sweeping across Europe. Do you think it's fair to view them in the same way? I mean, one big distinction is that the Swedish Democrats, which is the kind of closest parallel to Giorgia's Meloni's Brothers of Italy, they were the largest party in the right bloc, which was successful. So in that sense, they're similar. Except in Sweden, they're kept out of government. No one will partner with them. And they're certainly not going to get a prime minister from the Swedish Democrats. Tell us about that distinction.
I think the comparison is fair. It also shows you that the further you move up north in Europe, the stronger the resistance against right-wing parties, at least having them in government, tends to get. But you also mentioned something that I think is equally important. It has all the characteristics of a wave, but there is one particular problem with the wave. I think a lot of the votes, that whether it's the Sweden Democrats or whether it was the Brothers of Italy, a lot of these votes are protest votes. And these are very fragile, you know, very capricious votes. It's people vote for these parties not necessarily because they identify strongly with everything that party stands for. It is very often also because they want to vote against what they believe they stand even less for. And that, of course, does not really bind these people to your party. And this, I think, we see in Sweden, we see this in Italy, we see that in other parts of Europe as well. Maybe, I have to admit, with the exception of Hungary, I think Viktor Orban really has a basis of convinced followers. So Fidesz really is a popular party. But I think the Brothers of Italy and also the Sweden Democrats, I think they could be more accurately described as protest parties. And that is difficult. Right? If you are a voter, if I am a voter, if we give our voice, our vote to a party because we want to show somebody else in your face, that's completely different than us saying, I vote for this party because they really have a program, they have a vision, they have an idea that I wholeheartedly support.
Yeah, and we saw that in Italy. I mean, there was the Five Star Movement that was very popular and then fell away. There was the La Liga, the league that also had a big surge and then fell away. The moment they seem to get anywhere near government, quite often they fall out. So do you think it's almost like Meloni is just the new thing? She's fresh-faced, she hasn't been tried, she's a woman, feels different. She's the thing of the moment, and she might not be so popular in 2 or 3 years' time.
Certainly. I think that there's a 50-50 chance.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Of her becoming an Orban-like figure, or would you just describe another Berlusconi or another five-star movement Pepe Grillo figure? So it's too soon to tell. There is something else, however, and I hope that also the kind of conservative right-wing parties start to realize this. And this, I would say, also speaks a little bit for the voters. If you allow me a short digression into the Czech Republic, I mean, the most popular right-wing party in the Czech Republic is led by a politician who is half Czech, half Japanese. Meloni, as you just pointed out, is a woman. So it seems that even these, you know, quasi, you know, far-right, extremist, patriarchal, old-fashioned parties, they have no problem if their party is led by someone with a migrant background or is led by a woman. So it is about the issues. People do care about the issues. So this is not a question. Can they deliver? Are they willing to take the risk and say, this will be painful. We are running a high risk here, but we are trying to push through in a similar fashion, if you forgive the comparison again, as Orban did it in Hungary. So it's despite what newspaper headlines try to tell us, it is simply too soon to tell.
If we sort of zoom out then, I mean, do you think it's possible to look at the whole of Europe? I mean, I don't want to exclude the UK for now, and see a bit of a pattern that it looks like around 20%, but, you know, 20 to 30% of a lot of these countries are prepared to put their support behind a populist or a right populist candidate. Obviously, in France, we had... I mean, I'm not sure what exact percentage Le Pen ended up on. I think it was it 40?
Something like that, yeah.
You know, so France, we ended up with 40%+ for Le Pen, and Zemmour had a decent showing behind her. Sweden, we just had 20-something% for the Swedish Democrats. It's almost like an accident of the different systems of government, how it ends up playing out. But there is a sort of large vocal minority in a lot of Western European countries in favor of these kind of populist parties. And then almost as you drift eastwards towards Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary, that minority starts becoming more of a convincing majority. This is obviously zooming out and trying to generalize, but do you think that's a fair way of summing it up?
No, I think it's a perfectly fair way of summing it up. And the difference, I believe, that we can see is that in Eastern Europe, right-wing parties are not afraid, so to speak, of themselves, right? They are unabashedly right-wing, whether it's Poland, whether it's the Czech Republic, whether it's Hungary. In Europe, in Western Europe particularly, right-wing parties still have a problem because, of course, the party leadership and all these things, they have been marinated in the same social academic environment than their left-wing counterparts. So sometimes they seem to be almost afraid of really coming out as, you know, conservative or nationalist or right-wing. They kind of always try to soften their own stance. I think the willingness of people to vote for such parties like Fidesz in Hungary is pretty high also in Western Europe, if they could make a credible offer. To give you one example, I mean, Hungary is a country that, compared to every other country in the world, spends more of its GDP than any other country on family support. So these are policy proposals, I think, that would be quite popular in other countries as well. But no country really tries to go down that route, right? No country, and even right-wing parties, don't really dare to emulate this. If they would go out with such a program, a concrete program, I think they could get much, much more than 20%. Because as we said before, they are still mostly protest parties. The step to become a true populist, whether it's Italy, France, and even in Sweden, as you correctly said before, right, they get around 20%. That's not really kind of populism in the way, last time I mentioned it, as Orban and Fidesz have it in Hungary. If you get 51, 52% as a single party against an entire block of every other party in your country, I mean, that I would say that really defines populism as a proper term.
So you think the kind of key to success of these parties is family policy? Am I understanding you right? It feels like, yes, Viktor Orban has all of these policies to encourage people to have kids. I think you get taken out of income tax entirely after three children or something like that. But it's very hard to see how that would be popular in a Western European country, isn't it? Just because they're more Catholic, more traditional in Eastern Europe than they are in Western Europe.
If they truly, I mean, culturally, I guess they're more religious. If they're overall really more religious, I tend to have my doubts. It's a tricky question, but let me put it this way. If I would run a populist party in Germany or in Western Europe, I guess my first step would be to go out and say, over the last 20 years, we have done everything wrong that we can do wrong, from energy policy through migration policy to identity politics. All of these things have put our country, have put Europe on a downward path, on a downward spiral. And here would be the things that my party then would do differently. And you're right, it would be part of the mix. But I do think that is what people, at least intuitively, are feeling. And I want to be quite sincere here. I mean, the let's say, left-wing green ideology has been more devastating for Europe. We see this now, especially in the realm of energy and the realm of the economy, than anything that somebody like Orban or Meloni could ever do or have ever done in the past. So there is a lot there to tell people, here are the things that went wrong. People do have a sense of that their living conditions are getting worse, that their cultural identity is under attack. And I think family is part of that. I think you're absolutely right. It would be less that it's more money per month for your family, but it would be a clear signal. We value you. We value your family. We value motherhood. And as I said before, I think we underestimate that this is still something very real for most people, as we saw in Great Britain after the death of the Queen, right? I mean, this, I think, was a clear indicator that Queen and country means still a lot to many people, and I think it is not that unsimilar in other parts of Europe.
You touched there on energy and kind of green policies, and that seems like quite a convenient way that we can get into Germany, which is one country that we haven't yet talked about, because clearly German energy policy has not been very successful in past decades. Nuclear has been ruled out, perhaps overly quickly. That has made them additionally vulnerable to things like this current situation with Russia. Do you think that energy might see an increase in populist support in Germany in the coming years?
Yes, and we already do. We already do. The Alternative für Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany, which is the name of the most right-wing party in Germany, they did a poll recently. 91% of the Alternative for Germany support, for example, nuclear energy. That's more than in any other party. And they are now starting to gain in the polls again. Like a month ago, they had about 10%. Now they are at 14%. So that is more than a statistical exception or a statistical anomaly. So those parties are winning again.
I thought they've fallen back. I'm sorry to push back here, but the last elections Germany had, the AfD fell back. They didn't advance.
Correct, correct. No, they were on a downward track. They were at about 11% in the polls and about 10%. They had 10% at the last election. They kind of were about 11% during the last poll taken 2 months ago. But at the most recent poll taken last Sunday, they're at 14%. So there is a small but measurable upswing detectables. And I think that this is going to increase, depending also, of course, a little bit on how the party itself is going to behave. But once again, the potential is definitely there. They have the same problem that many right-wing parties in Europe have, which is a personnel problem. It is very, very difficult for, let's say, popular individuals, whether they, you know, with some kind of public recognition, to publicly announce, let's say, not allegiance, but support for such a party. So they always then have a very, very influential extremist fringe, and that extremist fringe also tends to get most of the media attention. So you can have, let's say, 90% of AfD party members and party functionaries being, you know, common sense, reasonable people, and then you have a fringe of really, you know, somewhat fascist approving, extreme right wing, you know, kind of anti-Semitic parts as well. But those are, of course, the ones that get most of the attention, which then means that everybody who thinks or feels like that in Germany, every anti-Semite, right, every fascist, will then flock to that party because they say, oh, wait a moment, that's the party who feels like I do. And then they overwhelm the more commonsensical, the more reasonable core. And that's always the risk that these parties have. So there is this structural obstacle to any right-wing party in Europe. Sweden Democrats, the same thing. And as we just said, the same in Italy. But it's also true with the Front National or the Rassemblement, as they're now called, National in France. Right? They always have the problem that their extremist fringe gets most of the attention, and thereby everybody who is on the extremist fringe in the country flocks to that party. And at some point, this is going to be a problem.
But to go back to this energy idea, there have been protests recently in Germany, haven't there?
Yes.
Which have been partly the right, people like AfD and others. But then there has been some attendance at those protests from people from the left.
Correct.
And there are some quite well-known politicians from the left party that are now speaking quite openly about things like the Ukraine situation, but also energy policy. Tell us about that. Is there any kind of left-right union in the offing in Germany?
There is an overlap. There, as you correctly pointed out, particularly when it comes to matters of economics, when it comes to matters of energy, there is an overlap. But the left party in Germany, they are currently, at the last poll I saw, at around 6%, 7%. So they don't really seem to recover in the polls at all. So it looks like that the voting population takes the right-wing opposition more seriously at this point than they take the left-wing opposition. But you're correct. Maybe to use another country as a quick example, we had the same in Austria. We had unions calling for demonstrations together with the right-wing party. So there is this overlap, and I think this overlap is going to grow, especially with the evolution of right-wing politics that we see not just in Europe, also in the United States. The right wing or conservatism, for better or worse, becomes more and more a working class movement, a working class phenomenon. And we'll see how this is going to play out in the future. But also what you mentioned before at the beginning of our conversation, they are no longer this kind of big business party. They are more and more reaching out, or sometimes involuntarily, to what we would call, you know, the lower middle class or the working class. And that, of course, also means that there is naturally an overlap then with more left-leaning or left-wing workers' representation and unions. Although I would not be surprised if we would see in future elections within unions that they themselves start to turn more right-wing.
Yeah, there's been a lot of features of localities within Italy that are notoriously communist voting that are now voting for Giorgia Meloni. zoom out for us then and tell me which country we should be looking at next. I mean, where do you think the next sort of populist moment might be found? Or do you think this is a high watermark and we're now going to see a kind of revenge of more centrist parties?
No, I don't think it's a high watermark, because I believe, and this is the big if for me, and I can only judge based on what I currently see, this might change. I think the actual European crisis is currently just building up. I think the true, let's say, wave of discontent will not materialize fully before the year 2023. And then the question will be, which populist parties will profit from that the most? Which populist parties will get the right people, will create the right messaging? That those can be left-wing parties or right-wing parties. There will be, I think, a huge pool of voters who would be willing to give their vote to whoever they believe can put an end to the uncertainty and the, if it's not actual misery, the feared misery, particularly in economic terms. So it's a little bit too soon to say which country it is going to be. I would always have my eyes on France, simply for historical reasons. The French are a country of revolutions and popular demonstrations and uprisings. We had the Yellow Vests in the past, right, that kind of put Macron to his knees. So there is already an infrastructure for a public resistance movement, if you want to call that. So that, I think, would be easy to mobilize again. We'll see what's going to happen in Eastern Europe, although I think things are there slightly more stable, at least for the moment. And Italy, of course, as we mentioned in the past, they tend to have, you know, elections on such a regular basis and shifting and collapsing governments on such a regular basis. It is absolutely possible that Meloni is going to be has been in, let's say, 6 months from now. I wish I could give you a better answer to this, but it's very uncertain. There is one uncertain factor that maybe we should keep most of our eyes on, and that is Germany. If current trends continue, if the deindustrialization in Germany continues, if this should really result in a heavy recession, current predictions say that the German economy is going to shrink by 3.5% in 2023. Personally, I think since a month ago, the forecast was 0.2%, so we moved from 0.2 to 3.5. So in reality, it's probably going to be 5 to 6%. This is going to have repercussions on the labor market. It currently looks, again, depends on what's happening in Ukraine. If there should be rationing in energy, if there should be California-style rolling blackouts, again, it's the worst-case scenario, but it is a possible scenario. I think then the current German government, it's impossible for them to survive. And if you get a populist uprising in Germany, they do it rarely, but when they do it, this would be, I think, of the most significant nature in Europe. So the idea is many have, oh, Germany, you know, they are heavy moving, they're an almost obnoxiously stable government. Not so sure about this. These days are over. So it's a powder keg. Many nations in Europe are currently a powder keg. We just don't know which one is going to blow up sooner.
I guess I would be more skeptical than you, probably, that Germany is going to go majority populist right anytime soon. It feels like there's such an allergy in that country to anything in that direction that I would say they're more likely to be the last. But we shall see. Let me ask about the UK, because that's the final country which we haven't talked about. And actually, in this context, it's kind of remarkable, because you do a tour of the map of Europe, and every major country has a substantial far right, or, you know, properly right wing party represented, except the UK. We had this UKIP phenomenon that has fallen away completely, and we now have very mainstream conservatives who, if anything, are sort of ultra liberals. I mean, the latest conservative leader would not agree with Giorgia Meloni on any of those topics that we've talked about. She is absolutely a social and economic liberal. Why is the UK so different? How did it happen that Brexit, which was interpreted across Europe as this kind of proto-fascist, dangerous right-wing movement, has led to the UK being the only country in Europe without a far-right party?
That's a fantastic question. I have to admit, the UK in this respect is also a little bit of a miracle to me. My answer, I guess, would be a twofold one. One is people, I assume, would like, the British people, I think, would like to have a right-wing party. This is why every time there is a change in leadership in the Conservative Party, there is the hope that finally this is going to be a true conservative, a true, you know, I think right wing always has a different flavor in Great Britain, also for historical reasons, but at least that it's going to be a, you know, a Churchillian, if you want, conservative. But every time it turns out what you just said to be more of a, you know, slightly right of left of center politician. And you mentioned Brexit. It's pretty clear to me. I hope I'm not mistaken in this judgment, but that cultural issues and especially questions of migration have been a core reason why the vote ended as it did, that why a majority voted for Brexit. But if we look at the actual numbers, right, there has been no turnaround in migration. So it seems as if the British people can vote for something, but the effect is negligible. And so it's justifiable that some, of course, ask, so why did we leave the European Union in the first place? But would there be potential for a right-wing party in Great Britain? I mean, you said it yourself, UKIP, it was a one-issue party that they successfully pursued to the end, but it showed that there is the potential there. It's the question if anybody is willing to pick it up.
It's almost like in the UK, such as some countries, like you might look at Denmark in this context, the system has been more effective at absorbing the populist impulses. So we had a dedicated Brexit party, and then the mainstream conservatives took it on and ultimately delivered it. And therefore, they sort of took the issue away. Some people might say this is how democracy should work. This is the dream situation, that you get these causes and then the mainstream establishment learns from them and delivers them. You could say the same in Sweden. A lot of parties have been kind of moving towards the Swedish Democrat position on immigration. And in Denmark, as I mentioned, even the Social Democrats, which is a centre-left party, have a very pretty much hard-line position on immigration and have been very successful electorally. So what's your view on that? Is that a dividing line we can make between European countries where the system absorbs it and adapts and delivers on those things versus ones where it becomes frozen out until it boils over?
Yes. No, I think that's a wonderful, both metaphorically and factually, I think that's a wonderful description. And as you just pointed out, Denmark is a great example. You can be a social democratic party and be very successful if you know in which areas you want to appeal and represent, let's say, the more conservative or right-leaning instincts of your population. This is exactly what you see. In other countries, those who move a little slower, I sometimes feel what you need is a wrecking ball. The best example there is, without beating this horse into the ground, but this was Donald Trump. And in the sense of you need somebody who's either so narcissistically self-convinced that they really do not care about what the system is, and they go in there, if you want, guns blazing. And some will justifiably say he wasn't successful, but I think that only tells us half the story, because such a quote-unquote crazy individual can then open the door to let's say, more reasonable, more thoughtful politicians who share the values of the previously mentioned wrecking ball. In the United States, it would be Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis would not be where he is without Donald Trump coming before him, because DeSantis realized, wait a moment, with these, you know, that kind of these culture war issues, but also the economic issues, you can win voters like across the board, from, you know, women to Latinos to blacks. You can win all these people with this messaging. But that would not have been possible without Donald Trump before that. Unfortunately, the UKIP movement in Great Britain, or Nigel Farage, did not have the same effect, right? That the Conservative Party said, wait a moment, there are these elements like the Danish Social Democrats that kind of we need to latch on. This is really popular. I think there's still the idea that it's not the people who tell the government in which direction to go. It's the government that tells the people in which direction to go. And I think that's not gonna fly in the long run. So something is gonna happen sooner or later, I believe, in the United Kingdom as well.
So your overall diagnosis then, Ralph, because we need to tie up now, is basically that far from this being the high watermark, you think populism is still on the rise broadly in Europe. And after this difficult winter we're about to have and into 2023, you expect populist parties to become more so, and Italy may not be the last of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are in a kind of in-between phase right now. If you take Germany, for example, since we talked about it before, the Social Democrats and the Conservatives as two parties, They were parties that at every election until the early 2000s, taken together, had around 60%. Both of them are now, the Social Democrats are at around 16% and the Conservatives are around 24-25%. So the time of the huge bloc parties, at the majority parties as they existed after World War II, that time is over. The question now is who and what is going to take their place. And I think what we will see in 2023, 2024, we will have those parties who adapt so that they can continue their existence. And then we will have what we have described as the populist parties, the new parties that will soak up those voters who are simply disconcerned with and unhappy with the existing political options. There might be a little time in between, which is that the group I just mentioned, those voters who might vote for the populists, I think they first will become non-voters and then they will become voters for those populist parties. Because if we look at participation in European elections, they have been declining for at least 20 years now. So that means there's a huge reservoir of people who does not feel represented at all by the political parties. And we will see which political party, either old ones or new ones, will be smart enough to scoop up that significant, we're talking about 30 to 40% of the electorate here. Who will swoop them up? Kind of who will convince them, go to the votes for me, right? Go to the polls for me. And that's going to demand more than just saying, I'm against the guys in power. You will have to say, I'm against the guys in power, and here is my alternative. And I think those parties who realize that will be quite successful, and we will see many new movements in the next year where we don't even know the names yet. So we are just at the beginning of a very, very interesting phase of politics in Europe.
Ralph Scholhammer, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Ralph Scholhammer, economics and political science lecturer at Webster University in Vienna, taking us on a little interrail tour of Europe's right-wing parties. Is he right, do you think, that there's more to come in the next year? Or will it go another way? Will it all calm down? Let us know in the comments. We always like to hear them. And thanks for tuning in, as ever. This was Unheard.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.